What does VA mean to me?
A place for my daughter to call home. Thanks to the VA Home Loan.
A new lease on life. The best healthcare team I've ever had is here at VA.
And education and the opportunity to open doors I never thought possible with my GI Bill.
The financial support I need to manage the disabilities I develop because of my service.
Get what you earn. Visit choose.va.gov.
Not all veterans are eligible for the type or amount of benefits mentioned here.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
It's the Monkey Show. And as we start the new academic year in this special edition in association with Rutledge, we've got a host of special guests to think through how we build student experience back better. It's all coming up.
You know, my kids sit all day watching relatively low budget, but relatively well produced material that is engaging and so on. You know, narrow casting is here, but they don't pay for it, and nor do I. And there's something really important built in here in terms of our assumptions of value that are going to be very difficult to kind of get across.
Welcome to The Monkey Show, your weekly way in to all the news, policy and analysis for higher education. I'm Monkey's editor, Debbie McVitie, and in this special edition, in association with Rutledge, we're talking about the student experience, the good, the bad and the ugly during the pandemic, and how we build it back in the year ahead. Over on the site, we've got an exclusive discount on Rutledge titles for Monkey Show listeners, so head over there after the show and fill your boots. Now, back in July, it was a blow for universities, if not really a surprising one, that national student survey results have taken a bit of a nosedive during the COVID-19 pandemic. Notwithstanding enormous amounts of hard work from academics, professional teams and SUs to keep the student experience going in some form, it's clear that students have had a very mixed experience. But we've learned a lot as well about online learning, about student engagement, about the vital importance of student community and social learning, and about student well-being. Now students are coming back to campus, for the moment at least, but what exactly are they coming back to? And how will their educational experience of the last 18 months shape or change their hopes, their expectations, and their preparedness for the year ahead? I think this isn't just about putting things in place that will help students reconnect or catch up in the short term. There are potentially some quite fundamental shifts in how we think about and understand the student experience, shifts that have implications for research and pedagogy, as well as professional practice. But while the sector continues to think through the implications of the pandemic, there are immediate pressures from policymakers, from media, and from students themselves to deliver the kind of student experience that can make up for 18 months of disruption and isolation. So to help us start to mine the rich seams of student experience policy, who better than Monkey's own associate editor, Jim Dickinson? Welcome, Jim. Jim, you've been spending the summer training new student union officers. What's been your highlight?
Oh, well, I mean, all sorts, really. Probably the highlight was a couple of weeks ago, I turned up to a student's union and, you know, we were about 45 minutes into a session and I was in kind of full flow. And all of the participants said, drink!
And what I was like, "What
had
you said?"
I was like, "Blimey, it's 10:45 in the morning. It's savages here." And apparently I'd used the word pedagogy.
Ah, right.
which apparently, you know, was part of their sort of code for, you know, don't, you know, some of the members of staff at their union all summer had been using kind of, you know, jargon words, and this is the last thing they wanted. And so, you know, at various other points then throughout the rest of the day, we were pretending to be drunk.
Well, on that note, I suppose if you're an SU listener to this podcast, apologies in advance. And and you know, rest assured, Jim and I will be taking many shots in the course of this conversation. But I mean, on a serious note, I mean, it sounds like you've been having a lot of fun. But I mean, of course, these are the same students who in many cases completed the NSS this year, and you know, and they are kind of facing quite a challenge, aren't they? They're having to, you know, lobby their institutions for you know, and represent student expectations, and you know, there's quite a lot of pressure on them as well to kind of deliver the student experience this year. So I mean, what have they been telling you about what their hopes and expectations are?
It is really hard to overestimate just how tainted some of the language is that was deployed this time last year when we were panicking about deferrals. So for example, the phrase blend, it has been impossible. I must, you know, I've been to about 25 students' unions so far this summer. It's impossible to use the phrase or write it up on a sheet of flip chart without it causing derision, howls of laughter, gallows humour. I mean, it is really, I mean, you can't say it. And some of that, I think, is about people kind of looking back on what was a spectacularly kind of grim experience for lots of people, and more grim, I think, than lots of us in the sector realise, with our actual chair that is our chair and our Wi-Fi that works and so on. But also, I think it reflects a bunch of things about mood music that was issued about the student experience this time last year, that for not particularly for universities, it wasn't particularly universities' fault, although you can have an argument over, you know, under or overselling, but that didn't pan out. It wasn't as described. And so, you know, there's lots of students' unions right now in the middle of trying to kind of build up students' optimism, take part in the kind of, you know, the sort of music that gets issued at this time of year that's about, you know, students kind of building back their mental health and coming back to a kind of, you know, fun experiences, that are still very, very cautious given, you know, how it panned out for them.
And I mean, and they have reason to be, don't they? I mean, we cannot be confident that although the plan is for everyone to come back on campus and have a lovely time, that that will be sustainable into the, you know, into the autumn term.
Well, this is it. So not only are the kind of prospects for what will happen still, you know, fairly vague. I mean, I was saying to someone the other day, someone was trying to persuade me, Jimmy, it's all going to be all right. You know, we're slowly coming out of the pandemic and so on. I said, you've got to put your head back into where we were this time last year, where, you know, we were into late August and, you know, we help out to eat out. Do you know what I mean? Everything was back. So that idea that it was all going to be fine was fine. But then, of course, on the other hand, you've got a bunch of people for whom the last thing they would want it to be is fine. There's a bunch of people with long COVID. There's a bunch of people who perhaps have lost someone during the pandemic. There's a bunch of people who are immunocompromised, who are very worried about coming back onto campus, being in packed out lecture theatres. And it has always been the case since the day one of the pandemic, reconciling the interests of the people who grasp at safety and the people who grasp at freedom. It's all, you know, every day that row has played out on Twitter, but it continues to be there now in a way that is genuinely uncomfortable as the country slowly, you know, air quotes, reopens.
Yes, and then that will really affect the kind of the day-to-day ability of universities, of researchers, of kind of people doing learning and teaching to I guess explain what they're doing and talk about what they're doing in ways that don't feel compromised or in ways that sort of cut through and resonate with people who are nervous, I guess, and or perhaps cynical about what the intentions are and what's actually possible, you know, the gap between promise and delay.
You know, there's absolutely no doubt that in some cases, some of the decisions being made about the conversion of hours of teaching into things that can only happen online rather than things that used to happen face to face is being done in a really kind of clever and sophisticated way, where there's been lots of thought put in about access and, you know, drink, two fingers, pedagogy and so on. But there's also no doubt that in other cases, those are highly, highly defensive moves, which are about being able to charge international students that can't get into the country and not having the artificial constraint of the size of a lecture theatre being a bar to the number of students you recruit. And the problem is, you only need a couple of courses or a couple of institutions where those two things that I've talked about are obviously the reason why, to cause mass kind of cynicism, distrust in an environment where we're desperate for people to trust us again and so on amongst students. And at some point that will feed through to their representatives. And, you know, one of the things that I'd say about that is, one of the things that strikes me quite often working with student unions in higher education is you can have the vast majority of institutions or the vast majority of a community within an institution doing things for the right reasons. If a couple of people do things for the wrong reasons, that spreads very, very quickly. You're only as trusted as the least trustworthy person in your kind of group, you know, the group of vice chancellors or group of academics or whatever it might be. And that poses real challenges for the kind of sector where, you know, there's still elements of the way of a kind of feudal craft system where, to some extent, we very slowly kind of move a community with us and carry, you know, both the most brilliant minds and also some of the most problematic kind of behaviours.
I think it is really interesting that you should frame it that way, because, I mean, as you know, I'm a kind of obsessive optimist, and some of the stuff that's been coming out you know, that I've heard, thinking that I've heard going on in the sector, I genuinely find really quite exciting. So I'm talking about, I guess, a new appreciation of the value of community and social learning, and understanding that, you know, interaction actually is important. But also, you know, and what I see is very, certainly a strong awareness of diversity and inclusion, in ways that perhaps are slightly different from where they were before, you know, as well as all perhaps, you know, there's some quite interesting stuff probably going on with technology in parts of the sector, and whether that kind of then translates into something that looks like a hybrid learning environment, I think, you know, sort of remains to be seen. But I suppose what you're saying, you know, if people who really want to investigate those things and who might wish to kind of roll out practice are going to have to be quite thoughtful, perhaps sort of with have their political antenna up about how they do that.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, there's a few things about that. First of all, when students join higher education, there's no doubt that they carry with them a set of assumptions about education, how it's delivered, the way in which it's delivered that is effective, that they have carried with them from previous educational experiences. And we can't discount the idea that just because higher education in at its absolute best has rapidly moved online, has rapidly pivoted online in certain ways, that isn't an experience that people will have had prior to higher education. And just because we've been getting used to it for 18 months doesn't mean that they've been experiencing anything other than something perhaps potentially more shambolic or hard to access or whatever before they enter. There's two other things though. One thing that does strike me is that narrow casting, particularly asynchronous materials, is you know, really interesting insofar as the way that has kind of caught on YouTube. Yeah, we now have, you know, my kids sit all day watching relatively low budget, but relatively well produced material that is engaging and so on. You know, narrow casting is here, but they don't pay for it. And nor do I. And there's something really important built in here in terms of our assumptions of value that are going to be very difficult to kind of get across. This idea that although it's cost us a lot of money in terms of staff time and perhaps production support and so on, people generally are not ascribing significant levels of value to asynchronous recorded material. And that is going to continue to be a big challenge for people, I think. But the other one, Debbie, that I talk about a lot is... we've all been on the 3 or 4 day conference, right? We've all arrived there at the registration desk and been told, you know, here's where the opening plenary is and here's where the various kind of workshops and breakout sessions are. What none of us have ever experienced, I think, is turning up at one of those events and being told that the opening plenary and 2 or 3 of the other major sessions are going to be online and we now need to return to our hotel room to watch them. And for me, I'm not being facetious about that. For me, the thing that's interesting about that is we have... distance learning as a kind of mode that has a funding support system attached to it and so on. We have in-person residential learning where you turn up to a city and you have to live there. We actually don't have hybrid modes of attendance. So whilst we might have developed quite cleverly, for really good reasons, hybrid teaching and learning experiences, we actually haven't really developed hybrid modes of attendance. And that is going to continue to be a problem for people who, when they happen to pick the modules they happen to pick, haven't actually got many hours where it justifies them paying out the rent for being there. So, you know, in the medium term, I think we're going to have to think really creatively.
It's a structural issue.
We're going to have to think creatively about hybrid modes of attendance.
Yeah, you need to challenge the plenary workshop structure, not necessarily, rather than kind of saying, oh, well, this bit of it is now online.
It's about the overall package, the overall experience, and where those kind of hours, if we still think of them as hours, those components, sit in the overall week.
And certainly, and, you know, and students and policymakers will see it that way. You know, it's kind of what's the kind of output, you know, output for the money.
Absolutely.
Or enough people will for that to be part of the picture, even if that's not how we would prefer it to be. I mean, okay, so what then would you say would be, if you're someone who wants to gather evidence in the next 3 to 12 months and you want to, what are the kind of research questions that you would have?
One thing that I would say is, I am guessing that, and I would be very disappointed if this wasn't happening, I'm guessing that there's a bunch of people somewhere that are seeking to work out, from a learning gain perspective, whether or not the kind of revisions to a particular subject or a particular clutch of modules in a university's changes as a result of the pandemic, that, you know, these good things that we've apparently learned over the past 18 months are good from, as I say, from a learning gain perspective, you know, whether people are achieving more, whether that's closing attainment gaps and so on in terms of changes to assessment, so on and so on. All those are really important. I worry a lot about the people who would instinctively reject the idea that alongside doing that, we measure perceptions of value. It is possible that a bunch of people will come out the back of this doing better, learning more, and perceiving that their experience was of even worse value than it was previously. And we can't just ignore that. So, of course, it is the case that teaching and learning professionals and senior managers in universities are going to think about the teaching and learning stuff. But we do have to carry people with us, particularly when they're making a lifelong financial contribution and when the taxpayer is making a contribution. We can't just say, well, we know best, look at our little pocket of research. So we need to understand people's perceptions of value along the way. And then the third bit is, obviously it is the case that if I look at 7 hours of, you know, kind of content that I've now reworked in a new way, some of which is more interactive, some of which is more diverse and so on, that I am on one level or another able to say to people at the end of each hour or at the end of a module, how did you find that? But what we obviously have to do is think about the mental health impacts and the overall kind of, you know, experiencing of the program impacts. Because if we've learned anything, Debbie, we've definitely learned that so much of the experience is about what happens outside of those hours. Learning is social. Social is learning. Not only are people learning from kind of social activities, but people are also learning in a social way, in a way that was harmed during the pandemic because they didn't really have friends.
Yes, and understanding what that experience means, both in terms of value, but also in terms of the sorts of outcomes that might not necessarily show up as learning outcomes or as defined learning outcomes, but it's all part of that broader kind of, I guess, graduate attribute piece. It's probably a sort of underplumbed seam, as I mix my metaphors horrifically. But that's but if you have the point, if you're going to build back student experience, you have to remember that it's the whole student experience. It's not just the bit where you can kind of see them and the whole thing's kind of curated and managed. It's the rest of it as well.
And you know the thing I would stress about that is that there's a really dangerous kind of seam of commentary on social media that says, okay, you've got the teaching and learning here in this box, and then you've got people, enjoying themselves in social events and in clubs and societies over here. And for me, what that misses is all of the stuff in between, where people are learning together in rooms, where they just go and book a room, or when they're sat in a social learning space, or they're sat in a kitchen, or where they're chatting on WhatsApp about their assignment, or when they're actually chatting on WhatsApp about the synchronous piece of teaching that they are in. And of course, that stuff is easy to miss and not look at. But my God, I mean, I've just spent hours this summer with student officers, not just education officers, but student officers of all sorts, just going on and on about how difficult they found that kind of, you know, second year of undergraduate experience, or how difficult they found their postgraduate year if they've just become a sab off the back of being a postgrad, in comparison to the year where they could see people and bounce ideas and so on and so on. It's really, really important, that stuff.
Jim, that is a brilliant way to start us off. Thank you so much. Next up, we're taking a deeper dive into two key themes of the pandemic: student engagement and international student experience. So joining me on The Wonky Show, we've got two fabulous guests. Tom Lowe is the head of student engagement and employability at Winchester and co-editor of A Handbook for Student Engagement in Higher Education. Tom, normally we ask about highlight of the week, but for the purposes of this podcast, I'm going to ask, what's been your highlight of the summer?
Thanks, Debbie. Great to be here. Certainly the highlight of my summer was attending two of my childhood friends' weddings this summer. And I think that was something we didn't necessarily expect to do this summer. So that's definitely my highlight.
Long awaited indeed. From near La Rochelle in France, one of the most exotic locations I think we've ever had on The Wonky Show, it's Elspeth Jones, who's Emerita Professor of the Internationalisation of Higher Education at Leeds Beckett University and series editor of the Rutledge series Internationalisation in HE. Elspeth, what's been your highlight of the summer?
Oh, hi, Debbie. It's great to be here. Well, we've been trying to get to our house in France all through the pandemic, and there's been changes in regulations on both sides of the channel. So finally got here, and I'm very happy to be here.
And I hope the sun's been shining for you as well.
Yeah, it has.
Unlike here in the UK. So let's get started. I mean, as you both know, I mean, this is a really interesting year for the student experience, to put it mildly. And you know, universities, I think, are looking to the year ahead and thinking about how, not just how to kind of, you know, help, you know, re-engage with students or kind of bring students back to something that might be approaching normality, but also how to move the student experience forward, to learn the lessons of the pandemic, to implement that in new and fresh ways as we make our way out of COVID. So Tom, I mean, you've worked on student engagement your whole career, and of course you've co-edited the Rutledge Handbook, and you know, you've been very hands-on throughout the pandemic with your team at Winchester. In your experience, I mean, how were you applying some of that kind of theoretical knowledge and practice in this incredibly distinctive context?
What a year to reflect upon in regards to student engagement. I think in the last year we have seen a generation of students and a generation of learners, no matter what level they are at, whether primary, secondary, further education or higher education, all experience an element of forced distance learning and perhaps an element of unprepared distance learning. I think back to lockdown one, I think the whole country went into distance learning overnight. And when you're looking at student engagement or students' engagements with an area of education like higher education, it's been really fascinating, but also terrifying to reflect on what our global sector has gone through. There's two areas I'd like to pick up, really. One is student engagement in the most broadest sense, or the most core area of higher education, which is student engagement in learning. Every student engages in their curriculum in some way to simply be a student and to simply pass as a student in higher education. And that learning, that core element of student engagement, which 100% of students take part in, and my definition of an engaged student is a student who's just enrolled on their course, was completely shattered and experienced an incredible earthquake and a seismic change, which many of us didn't expect when we went back to work after Christmas in January 2020. And perhaps many of us are still not comfortable 100% that we are getting it right at the moment, though we're definitely, colleagues across the whole HE sector are giving 110% to make sure we do everything we can. But student engagement became a lot less active, a lot less in person, and it became a lot less personal. And I think the promise of a Western higher education university experience is a face-to-face campus experience, which gives you the memories, the best time of your life, some of the best friends you ever have, and some fantastic engagements, whether that's in the class, being inspired by a lecturer, meeting some of the best friends in your halls of residence, maybe learning something that's going to lead to a great career, but also sports teams and societies and the student union, all of these fantastic things that we know higher education for. A lot of those elements of student engagement rely on the physical. They rely on people being in a room at the same time. Now, we can get around those and do things online, just like we're having a conversation today, but it's a challenge still to recreate that same personal element when we are not able to be in the room together and many of us have our cameras off. So it's been challenging, though there has been some amazing innovation, which perhaps we'll talk about later on, especially in regards to the great convenience higher education is now able to be engaged with. For example, we don't necessarily even need to leave our houses and commute an hour and a half across London. The other area is student voice. And I think student voice has had a huge focus in UK higher education, but globally, definitely for the last 10 years, longer in some nations. And we have prioritized through the QAA in the UK and NUS to be engaging our students in their experience, listening to students' voices. Now, again, that's something the most pure form of student voice is when people are in the room speaking to their staff members of the university. But in the last 10 years, there's also been lots of technology solutions for student voice come forward. Obviously, one of them is the online survey, but others are different apps and technologies where you can give your student voice. But Adam Fletcher, who's a scholar who talks about student voice from kindergarten to university level in the United States, highlights that actually, it doesn't matter how, if you're gathering students' voices, that's fine. But if that student voice interaction isn't meaningful, if we are not there to be able to respond to that feedback and appreciate that feedback and have a conversation about that feedback, things begin to go wrong. And I think we've seen some of the largest, most loud student voice I have ever experienced in my career of higher education during COVID-19, rightly so, because everybody has been in this crisis together. And it's actually dwarfed the tuition fee rise of 2011, 12, 13. But we haven't necessarily always got it right as a sector, because we haven't necessarily been able to respond in the same way, because we've been responding to tweets, or we've been responding to feedback mechanisms, or we've been responding to emails, rather than being able to speak to people in a space. And I think HE is a lot about getting people in a space together. So for me, the two main areas of student engagement that have shifted and have been impacted, and where I've had to draw on literature and thinking around student engagement, is that core area of student engagement with learning, but then the substantial foundation area of student engagement, which is student voice.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I mean, there is this kind of enormous debate unfolding. It's interesting that you really emphasize that in person, because I mean, we know students are calling for a return to in person, and of course they are, because that's their experience. But we are also hearing from some universities that they've seen student engagement in learning, certainly that kind of core learning, curriculum piece, go up during the pandemic, possibly in part because students have got, you know, very little else to do, and they've been stuck in their rooms, you know, and really all they've been able to do is kind of watch online lectures and that sort of thing. But there is this sense that technology could act in the year ahead in a well-developed hybrid context to improve student engagement or to allow perhaps a greater diversity of students to engage. Is that something that you're thinking about?
Well, first of all, imagine if we went through COVID-19 during the 90s in higher education, or even earlier. We would not have had the fantastic technology platforms that we now have that enable us to connect with individuals throughout the world in an almost instant way. I think HE would have just had to outright cancel, or maybe even they would have plowed through COVID. I don't know. I think looking ahead and thinking about the big debate that is going on right now, not just in HE communities like Wonky, but even in the press, the weekend just behind us, we saw the Daily Mail headlines talking, almost calling some universities cowards for not returning face to face. And we are not decided. We are not decided as a university community. We are not decided as individual universities. And we are not decided as a society about what the future of education is, because absolutely we cannot ignore the accessibility benefits of online education. The fact that a commuting student no longer has to pay money and to take an hour of their time to travel all the way to campus just for an hour-long meeting with a lecturer to go all the way back. Similar with well-being services. Anything that's one-to-one or anything that's short, I think we have to keep online. But we can't ignore that most of our UK providers are campus-based universities. They might be in the centre of a city, but they have a heart, they have a campus. And the question is beginning to be asked, and Dr. Zachary Spire is asking this question, what's the purpose of a campus anymore if we put everything online? Do we need these great buildings, like many corporate companies are saying, do we need these great big office blocks anymore? Well, if we're doing more and more online, and campuses and spaces of learning are places where you will walk around and you'll have conversations and you'll meet people and you'll go to the library. Well, if we put all of that online, do we need the other space still? And who do we listen to here? Do we listen to our current students? And there are a huge chunk of our current students who are absolutely praising the fantastic abilities of being able to engage online from home. It's very convenient. It's very accessible. It doesn't cost as much in finance time or time, or it's fantastic for parents or anyone with a caring responsibility. And also the information can be slowed down or taken at students' own individual pace, which is fantastic for students, for neurodiverse students. But there's another argument going on right now as well. And perhaps that's because we're societally induced to think that HE has to take place on a lush green university campus like we see in the American movies. If we have our students asking for it, there's a bit of many universities that think, well, we need to provide that. But then I think there's also many universities that have big international student cohorts, and this is my own personal opinion, that maybe think, well, actually, we can't deliver everything on campus because otherwise our international student cohorts might not be able to come, and then we might lose that tuition fee. So there's a big debate between the two. Now, I guess I can only personally answer myself, but I am an extrovert, both. So being an extrovert, I naturally want to be around people and probably naturally favour face-to-face. But I think this is a personal thing. And just like we're seeing just this week, we've seen some stories about the future of the workplace. We will likely see more jobs being advertised that this is a work from home job. And I think in the future, people will choose working at home versus in office working. And now we've all experienced it. We kind of know what it's like, and we know if we like it, and we also know if we hate it. Actually, we have a whole generation of learners, no matter what level they are at, who have experienced distance learning, and they will know if they like it, and they will know if they hate it. And perhaps they will vote with their feet.
Let me come to you, because Tom's talking about the diversity of students and lots of different needs. And you know, as editor of the Internationalizing Higher Education series for Rutledge, I mean, you must have been thinking very kind of hard about what that international experience has been like. back. Obviously, during the pandemic, it's made international travel, international mobility very difficult. I mean, from your perspective, what have we lost in terms of creating that rich international learning environment?
Yeah, well, we have lost a lot, and in other ways, we've gained, I think. But I just want to come back to something that Tom was talking about, and that's the in terms of students being online and being able to access their courses digitally, we've got to remember that not everybody has the same range of skills as everybody else. And indeed, not everybody has access to the internet in the same way. If we're thinking about international students, for example, there are many countries in Africa, as an example, where people have had real difficulty getting access to the internet and access to digital technology. We must also remember that probably there are many parts of rural Britain where access to technology or access to the internet is much more limited than it is in cities. So we're in danger of thinking about the majority of people who do have good access, who do have good skills, and forgetting that there are lots of people who maybe don't. And this may be true for example, mature students or people who are coming to university for the first time. So we've got to bear in mind the diversity of our student body in many different ways, including access and capability with technology and the internet. And also thinking about international students more broadly, we must remember that it's not simply students not being able to travel, but also some international students actually stranded in the country of their destination, can't get back to home, can't see their family, and they've been stuck in an environment they're perhaps unfamiliar with, not being able to really spend time with other people. And so there've been so many problems, haven't there? But I think in terms of lack of mobility generally, obviously it's prevented perhaps recruitment of international students, which contribute to the finances of universities. But it's also made it more difficult, I think, for people to engage in the classroom, as Tom has mentioned. That encountering diversity and encountering a range of different people from different backgrounds, of all different kinds of backgrounds, whether it be international, different ages, different abilities, different, cultural contexts. These are the kinds of things which our university experience also facilitates. And it's really important that students are able to engage with people that they view as different from themselves in order to raise their own perspectives, change their mindsets, think differently about perhaps things that they've been used to think differently about how, perhaps the way I've always done things isn't necessarily the best way. Perhaps think they do things differently in other countries. Perhaps different cultures have got ways of doing things and working with each other that can help me, can help my future, can help my life as a citizen or as a professional. And so it's that exposure and engagement with people from different backgrounds of all kinds that is the benefit of a campus experience, isn't it? It isn't quite the same as engaging online. I mean, I've been very fortunate. In fact, I worked out there was 1 week where I was actually speaking or engaging with people on six continents within a single week. Now, obviously, I couldn't have done that if I'd been traveling. This is a combination of through teaching and work with students. But there are incredible benefits, but that's assuming that I can get in touch with people that I want to get in touch with, isn't it? And that they've got the same access to technology. Just a brief plug. There's a book in my series by Shantan Chang and Catherine Gomez that's recently been published about digital experiences of international students and the danger of assuming that everybody has the same set of capabilities and access, whether it's from, if you're trying to recruit students and if you're trying to teach them and if you're trying to work with alumni, the whole student life cycle. We make way too many assumptions about our students' capabilities. And I think that's a really important point to bear in mind.
But I mean, you mentioned also that we gain something. And, when you're talking about technology and the ability to kind of reach beyond one's immediate context, and we're certainly, throughout the year, we've heard feedback from students and from staff sort of saying, we're doing all kinds of really interesting stuff here because the technology has made that possible. I mean, how's that been playing out in the international space?
Yeah. And again, I think we, as Tom said, it was unprepared. We were thrown into it, weren't we? And we all had to suddenly find new skills that we hadn't realised we didn't have for the current situation. There are lots of interesting developments, though, and I think the problem has been with internationalisation is that people, governments, institutions, individuals often have assumed that the key thing is to get students into another country, and then all will be magically, we'll all gain these insights and skills that we never had before, and that's not the case. I mean, we need to provide interventions and support students who are traveling to other countries, and we can't assume they're going to gain these skills simply by being in another country or working with international students. We've got to facilitate that. So the assumption that mobility is the answer to everything has been questioned through these times. And I really welcome that, because I'm my great interest is internationalization of the curriculum and how we can actually reach 100% of our students, not the 7% or whatever it is that currently in most recent years have been mobile. The European target was 20% by 2020, and relatively few countries have actually met that target. So we're talking about really a very elite number of students. It's a small number of students who get to travel, and focusing all our efforts on the mobility experience means that we don't focus enough on internationalizing the curriculum for all of our students and providing international dimensions, alternative approaches, different mindsets, helping to work with them to develop the kinds of skills they're going to need to live and work in a multicultural society, basically, is what we're talking about. And that's the focus of internationalization, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, that's fascinating, because I suppose I might have made the argument that the pandemic came at the worst possible time. If you think about, we had Brexit, and then we had the transition out of the EU, and then before Britain could really kind of rethink what its place was in the world and how where universities might sit within that, the pandemic came and made life sort of extra complicated. But I suppose maybe what you're saying is that the pandemic opened up opportunities to actually think about internationalization in a different way. I mean, how might you see that kind of playing forward as we return to something approaching normal in the year ahead?
Well, there are certainly lots of examples of people taking the internationalization opportunities within the curriculum more seriously. So the COIL program, which is a kind of collaborative online international learning programs, that kind of approach has become much more common, I think, where people have been interested and tried to engage their students with people, individuals or classrooms of people or people on Zoom in different countries. And there have been more examples of that happening. There's also been a big increase in virtual internships, for example, not simply virtual mobility, but virtual internships where students are working with international companies in different parts of the world, or indeed international companies in their own country. So, but actually doing all of this online has been a facilitation, in a sense, of rethinking the way we think about teaching and learning in an international context. That we need to be thinking more about how we get our students to adopt a mindset which allows them to think differently. How is my subject considered and delivered in different parts of the world? What are the things I should be thinking about which are relevant in different dimensions of society? And how can I work with people who are perhaps not from the same background as myself? What can I learn from them, and so on? And these are things which can be facilitated, I think, to some extent online. And obviously, if we can ever get back to an in-person experience, so much the better. The Council of Europe has done some really interesting work on what they call competences for democratic culture. And they look at things like skills, values, attitudes, which we need to develop amongst our students, amongst our populations, in fact, to live and work together in harmony or to try the best we can. And I think we've got a great opportunity in higher education to at least try and take forward those kinds of areas which are so important for making our society better in the long run, and for perhaps, shall we say, getting over some of the schisms that have been caused by or have been facilitated through the Brexit vote and the way society has developed since then.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Tom and Elspeth. It's been a really fascinating conversation. Finally, I caught up with Stephanie Marshall to help unpack the challenges for leaders in the student experience in the year ahead. Really pleased to welcome to the show Stephanie Marshall, Vice Principal for Education at Queen Mary University London, and of course, former Senior Executive and Chief Executive at the Higher Education Academy, and a long and distinguished career in learning and teaching academia, of course, and also the author of the Handbook of Learning and Teaching in Higher Education. So Stephanie, I just thought you would have such an interesting perspective on this question of building back student experience higher, because you're bringing that academic informed insight to your practice as a leader of learning and teaching. But obviously the pandemic has been a very, very distinctive experience for all leaders of higher education. And, what do you feel like you know now that perhaps you didn't know at the start of the pandemic?
Oh, gosh, Debbie, where do I begin with that? It's probably so much what do I know now that I didn't know before, but what has been exceptionally reinforced. And that's been really, really important. I think the key thing is, if we're putting students at the centre of learning, which is exactly where they should be, listen to the students better, discuss with them more, get to know them better, and work with them. And I just feel working with our student union exec officers, particularly over the past year, we've had such an incredibly hard year, but have forged the most amazing relationships in terms of supporting each other. I guess the whole move to online, second point I'd make is the whole move to online was fascinating, really, because suddenly, what does designing an online module look like? And I thought, oh, gosh, we really have to go back to basics here, because some people don't really understand kind of learning outcomes and how that translates into module design and how that interrelates with graduate attributes, kind of things that maybe we just took a bit too much for granted. And of course, we have them on our new to teaching programs. So, I mean, I went right back to program and module design and all that wonderful work by John Biggs on solo taxonomy. And I thought, this is so simple. Let's remind everybody what the building blocks are in terms of our thinking. Scaffolding, I'd throw out that term. And I said, we've got to even offer more scaffolding than we did before, you know, Vygotsky's notions of scaffolding. And had to kind of re-go through that with a number of people as well. So I think some of these basics, level indicators, let's go through Bloom's taxonomy. It was almost going into the annals of time in terms of things that we need to remind ourselves are really, really important when thinking about program and module design. Of course, you mentioned the Taylor and Francis Edition 5, Teaching and Learning in Higher Education. And I thought, oh gosh, I can actually pull that out now and start getting people in the disciplines to look at the different hyperlinks in there as well as to resources they should and could be using that will actually save them time in terms of when they're putting the modules together. I think in terms of other learning, it is interesting when you reflect on your own practice and your own research and writing and think, am I doing what I profess to do? And I think in terms of my own leadership, I did, Debbie, reflect an awful lot on, am I leading to the best of my ability in terms of supporting the whole community in this shift that's required as a result of the pandemic? And you might not be as familiar with Strategic Leadership of Change in Higher Education, which is another Taylor and Francis publication of mine, where I proposed a new model of leadership, which was based much more on the research and what I knew about leadership, I guess, from being a chief executive. But I just thought, how is this applying in the pandemic? And in that book, I outlined this model E4, which is about engaging, energizing, empowering, and remaining engaged. And I thought, more than ever, with the pandemic, that remaining engaged bit was absolutely crucial, because I just thought it's one thing working together with an infrastructure of support through deans, through school representatives, directors of education, program directors. And we met fortnightly in terms of kind of managing the whole process together. But I just thought it requires me not just to be leading this, but when I'm saying, for example, we could really do with some training on this and being engaged in that training with them so I could hear what they were saying and really staying true to the journey And I think that at times was difficult because it has been a long 18 months. But I think it was that let's work collectively in this journey to see that we come out the other end. And maybe that coming out the other end is a bit naive because we're not nowhere near out the other end. But it's felt like a really collective effort. And I have really, really appreciated great staff, great students in that collective effort, probably more so than I could have ever imagined.
I mean, to me, what you're describing sounds a bit like, I guess, what I think of as praxis, in the sense that you're kind of trying to triangulate what you know and see in your day to day and what you understand from engaging with the kind of wider literature and evidence base. And I suppose engagement is a really is a kind of interesting framing for that, because you're sort of saying, I'm not just thinking about some of these kind of texts in learning and teaching. I'm listening to academics and students the whole time as well, and sort of having and trying to kind of make that knowledge meaningful in a particular context. I mean, what surprised you about that process? I know you said, you know, you're surprised that everybody or kind of, I guess, appreciated that everyone was able to come together and kind of and undergo this process. But were there aspects of things that were happening that felt underexplored where you kind of, I suppose, collectively came to a new understanding of what it was you were trying to do?
I think that's a really, really interesting question. I think the notion of praxis, absolutely right. I'd be with you 100% there, because I think that's as an educationalist, as a leader, I've always felt that the praxis was the way I operated. But for whatever reason, it felt more real. Probably we were working really, really long days, but still, nevertheless, with it being such a massive enterprise and thinking we've got a really tight time frame for getting this right as well, because guidance was changing. Things happened overnight, of course, with going online. I guess what surprised me perhaps was maybe the speed with which we were able to corral support, but also what maybe surprised me, and it shouldn't have done really, was how quickly junior colleagues stepped up to the breach in terms of what I'd call stepping up to leadership. Hey, you know what? I'm a tech savvy junior academic. I can help. Use me across faculties, I don't mind. And we suddenly saw this emergence of all these junior colleagues who were actually positively excited about the opportunity that afforded them. And I think that's the point at which probably I felt, actually, I'm going much more into stewardship mode here, because my responsibility is, and maybe even my own perception of self had changed very much from leading it into very much stewardship in terms of corralling wherever there was support. I needed to draw on that and help it take us along. So and then there must be a number of people in the sector that were thinking broadly similar things, because I just think, I have to say, Wonk HG, I think you've been absolutely brilliant in terms of some of those blogs that were coming out so regularly and in such a timely fashion. And I'm just thinking about the Jilly Salmon's blog came just at that time. People might remember that blog, which was about the various pivot points in terms of the move to blended.
Yes. We'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah. To me, it was brilliant, because I then used that in kind of, let's look at this and just use kind of the diagram, and had various sessions with program directors, which was easy because I was doing it on Teams, so I could get everybody there at short notice. I could regularly get people involved in different two-hour sessions as well. Sometimes people with toddlers on their knees, et cetera. But that flexibility that was afforded us in terms of getting together and looking at things and saying, right, let's look. This is what Jilly Salmon, who's really, really eminent in the field of IT, blended learning, online learning, what she's saying about what we need to do next. And it mirrored exactly where we were at that point in terms of, by last summer, thinking we've got to spend this summer really ratcheting up what we do. We've got to bring in some third party help. We've got to make sure students are giving us the ongoing feedback as well in terms of whether this stuff is working or not. So I suppose it was a nice position to be in as well in terms of the stewardship role and kind of taking a bit of leading from behind rather than always leading from the front. And if that makes sense.
It absolutely does. And it's certainly something that is meaningful even in a post-pandemic environment when it's less kind of high crisis, high anxiety kind of situation as
well. Yeah.
Your point about kind of, I guess, you know, returning to the old favourites, particularly around learning design and delivering high quality learning design, I think that will resonate a lot with a lot of people, because, of course, it was this kind of enormous module redesign for particularly for the online environment. And then I guess some of those skills will translate to the future, even if, you know, lots of modules will no longer be fully online, which, of course, you know, is what we're all hoping. But thinking about the wider student experience, I mean, I feel like so much what we learned about the pandemic was about I guess the need for student community, and about perhaps the extent to which universities are able to foster student community, or to the extent to which that had been actively fostered as part of a learning strategy. I mean that's one that leapt out at me, and I think, you know, lots of universities will be thinking about going forward. But are there things about the kind of wider student experience that you're now thinking we need to take a more active role in, but actually maybe the literature isn't as well developed, and we need to be thinking about in a deeper way?
Well, I think there's a number of things, but one that struck me that we introduced during the pandemic, which has to continue, is the use of town halls, because it's been so easy for head of school to be able to hold a town hall meeting with the students and to get feedback on what's been working well, what not so well. And then we've upped the number of staff student liaison committees that we had. So we were having them fortnightly originally, so we could get that feedback as to what was working well. The number of them that said they so enjoyed and appreciated the town hall meetings and having the head of school, you know, seeking out their views and asking them how they were settling in, or, you know, what's working well, what are any of your anxieties about the assessment that's forthcoming, etc. So it would be really interesting to explore, I think, a lot more in terms of what has the use of Teams and Zooms enabled us to do that we couldn't do before, that students suddenly feel we can be so much more engaged as a result of that. And I think there's various touch points where they just, you know, they could be at home, just click on and you're going to have an overview and an opportunity to ask questions if you so desire.
Yes. I think, understanding what student engagement and student voice means in a digital context is a pretty feels quite urgent, and we'll certainly talk about that a bit more with Ed Tomlow, who's going to come on the podcast as well. Yeah. I mean, do you have particular kind of priorities and plans at Queen Mary in terms of thinking about building back the student experience? I know this is the context for we've got lots of students coming back, their education has been disrupted. That doesn't necessarily mean that they are going to, you know, that they will have had very kind of distinctive sort of experience, I suppose. Doesn't necessarily mean that they have a lack or they haven't learned, but their academic confidence may be a bit lower. They may have experienced kind of challenges with their well-being in the past year. So thinking about that student experience for next year, what will that look like, and what's kind of front of mind as you're planning for that transition back to something approaching normal?
I think that whole student experience, but being part of communities and staff and student engagement, is a really, really central concern of ours, particularly thinking about the students coming in this autumn, given that they'll have had 2 years of disruption. To what extent have they been socialized in terms of thinking about what the norms of university might be, given that, you know, sixth form or college or, you know, mature entrance? What has helped them think about what the university will look like this autumn? So I think we'd started getting rather anxious about this back at the end of the last calendar year, and thought come January we wanted to start planning some ways of engaging different student communities. So we went out to the students to say, what sort of communities of practice do you like being involved in? What can we do more about student engagement? So we've worked really, really closely with the students in coming up with what we're calling the Get Ahead program, that we've started via a website already. So if students are even thinking about Queen Mary, they can join some different communities that might be of interest, either disciplinary or just more social and to do with our societies. For those then that had given firm offers for Queen Mary, then also thinking they could have a buddy, you know, somebody who is a student ambassador or a third year, somebody's applied for the role and had the training for the role, so that they feel there's one person there. If they've got any anxiety or questions, they can ask. But then part of the deal is then come August, and of course we're already in August, we're then joining up into larger communities, so they're in a sort of smaller family grouping before they even arrive, because what we wanted to avoid was any student arriving and feeling completely lost and not knowing quite what to do, because they haven't really been interacting that much whilst during the pandemic. So student engagement, student communities has been a massive piece for us. And already, I was just talking to some of our student ambassadors on campus yesterday. We're absolutely thrilled. So we've got some really lovely students that are hoping that they'll be here next year. And we're really enjoying working with them. And of course, our student ambassadors are paid as well. So it's great paid employment for our student ambassadors. But we're just hoping, I mean, it's just we're just hoping we will have to monitor and evaluate all the way in terms of, is this delivering what we hoped it would be delivered? Because it is a co-created package of work. But I think it was around about Easter that we also decided, right, we've worked out the funding for this Get Ahead program. Actually, you know what? We need it to be for every year and all the time, because it's got things like modules on, you know, help with maths, help with academic writing. It's got a range of things where we think where we thought actually a number of prospective students are perhaps lacking in the skill set they need to succeed. So let's get all these things online. And then we thought, actually, you know what? All our students need them. Let's have different levels. Let's have different means of mixed mode. They can do it online, or they can do it mixed mode, or they can have face-to-face once they get onto campus, subject to us being able to carry on in-person teaching.
Yeah. But I think this is a really important point, is that a lot of the things that will be coming out of the pandemic this year will be things that ought to stand students in good stead for, you know, many years to come. And with that in mind, I mean, you mentioned monitoring and evaluation, and I think that that's so important. I mean, in terms of the evidence you're gathering and about your kind of, I guess, how it's developing our collective understanding, is that something that you're keeping quite close to the fore, especially if you're thinking this now becomes a sort of a baseline that you know, you'd want to build from?
Yeah, we certainly are, Debbie. And I think we're also very, very aware now that we should start publishing some more of the findings of what we do. And I think we're trying to do a bit more blogging to give other people ideas as to what they might do. I think another thing that our students have really, really valued that I'd just like to highlight that we want to track as well is building on our values. So make sure our student engagement, our student communities are very much based on Queen Mary's values, which are number one, you won't be surprised to hear, is inclusivity. Absolutely crucial. But we felt it's IPACE. So the second one, P, is for proud. You know, making staff and students feel really proud of what we're offering. Well, we can't do that unless we've got a really good offer, and which we feel that we have now. But as you say, we've got the baseline, but we now need to track. So what impact does that have on the student journey, and then ultimately on the student outcomes? Ambitious. In terms of our IPACE as well, encouraging everybody to be ambitious about what we can achieve. And I think we're thinking we achieve more as a collective. We really learned that during the pandemic, that working together has been really powerful. And which takes me to our penultimate value, which is collegial. And it shouldn't come as any surprise that the collegiality that emerged in the face of it's all got to go online. Now we've got to work together to make this even better. We need to make sure we carry on with that, because it's made people feel rather excited about being part of teams. People that might have been quite individualistic before are finding that working in teams has been really rewarding, and they've learned a lot from each other. And then finally, unsurprisingly, the E at the end is about ethical. So. And the students have really picked up on that as well, and said even decision making, as long as we go into any decisions that are made, to say, is it a values led decision making process? And that's really helped a lot of things with a lot of things, to be able to preface any discussions on, let's base it on our values. So that's probably a good bit of learning that's come out as well, that will continue. And I think help us build back better, because A, we can call people out if they aren't kind of values based. And it's also helping us. That's the baseline. We don't go beneath that baseline of our values.
Right, that's about it for this week. We'll be back with our regular show from the first week of September. To delve deeper into anything we've discussed today, and to get that exclusive discount on Rutledge titles, you'll find links in the show notes. Remember, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show on your favourite podcast directory, or you can find the feed that you need on wonky.com/podcast. So it's thanks to Jim, Tom, Elspeth and Stephanie, and to our partners at Rutledge, and to the whole of Team Wonky for making the show happen. And until next time, stay wonky.